Chapter 10. The Long Road to Safety. After the war, Schindler's Jews would shake their heads and try to understand the complicated motives behind the head director's willingness to risk his life to save them. Most of them said quite simply, "I don't know why he did it." Others came to the conclusion that he enjoyed the games he had to play and the deals he had to make in order to keep them alive. Others said that he loved the satisfaction he felt in doing good, or that he was a rebel, working against the evil he saw in the Nazi system. But none of these explanations could fully account for his fierce determination in the autumn of 1944 to find another safe place for the DEF workers. Schindler's first step was to go to Berlin to talk to his friend Colonel Erich Lang at Army headquarters. Lang could guarantee military contracts and strongly recommend to the Army High Command that Oscar be given permission to move his factory and workers to Zwittau. Lang wanted Oscar's plan to work, but he told him,
"We can do it, but it will take a lot of money. Not for me, for others."
With Lang's support, Oscar was able to get approval from Berlin. But there were still problems. The governor of the Liberec area around Zwittau refused to allow any labor camps with Jewish prisoners in his district, and he had successfully kept such camps out throughout the war. Oscar was told to speak to an engineer in the weapons department named Susmuth, and was reminded that if he wanted to get anything done, he should come to meetings with a good supply of sausage, top-quality tobacco, wine, whiskey, and coffee. Oscar was used to this sort of thing, but by 1944 the price of such luxuries was extremely high. Nevertheless, Oscar continued spending. In the middle of Oscar's trip to Berlin to see Susmuth, Amon Goert was arrested. Someone who was jealous of the commandant's very comfortable lifestyle had reported him, and now he was sitting in jail waiting for his trial as senior SS investigators examined his finances. They did not care about the number of people Goert had shot from his balcony, or the number of Jews he had had killed on the hill behind his camp. They were more interested in his black market businesses and how he had treated some of his junior SS officers. They also searched the apartment Goert kept in Krakow and found a large amount of cash, almost 1 million cigarettes, and many other luxury items piled from floor to ceiling. He had obviously been using the flat as his private storehouse. The investigators called in Helen Hirsch and Mitek Pemper, but they were both sensible enough to keep their mouths shut. They knew what happened to prisoners who told the truth about the commandants. They were usually dead within hours of talking. They both wisely played the role of polite, blind servants, and soon the SS police took them back to Plaschow. Goert's arrest had given these two a better chance at life, unless he was released too soon. But Goert was not released. His powerful friends did not step forward to help him, and the investigators were both shocked and envious at the way the commandant had been living. Oscar was concerned about the investigations into Goert's lifestyle and was worried that he would also be arrested or at least called in for questioning about his friendship with the former commandant. He was right to be worried, because Goert explained some of the cash in his Krakow apartment by saying,
"Oscar Schindler gave it to me to make life easier for his Jews."
But fortunately, Oscar was not called in to answer questions about Amon Goert at this time. To his surprise, Oscar did not need the whiskey and diamonds he took to his meeting with engineer Susmuth, an honest and moral man. Oscar learned that he had also proposed the idea of building some small Jewish work camps in the border towns between Poland and Czechoslovakia to make weapons for the German army. Even though these camps would be under the central control of either Auschwitz or Gross Rosen, Susmuth knew that if the prisoners were in smaller camps, they would have a greater degree of safety. Unfortunately, he had got nowhere with his plan because of objections from the local governor. Susmuth did not have enough friends in high places to change the governor's mind, but perhaps Schindler, with the support of Colonel Lang and others, had the necessary influence.
"Herr Schindler," said Susmuth, "I have investigated the border area and have made a list of suitable sites for small labor camps. There is one on the edge of Brinlitz. Do you know this village?"
"Of course," replied Schindler. "It's very close to Zwittau, my hometown. Which place are you talking about?"
"It's a cloth factory owned by the Hoffmann brothers from Vienna. The business is very successful, but they have a very large building standing idle."
"I know the factory you're talking about, and there's a local railway line from Zwittau to Brinlitz," said Oscar.
"Yes, I have that in my report," said Susmuth.
"But do you have in your report that my brother-in-law is in charge of the railway yard in Zwittau?"
"That's very good news," said Susmuth, smiling. "I will write to Berlin and recommend the Hoffmann building for your factory. With Colonel Lang behind you, I think you will succeed where I failed."
Oscar left Susmuth and drove to Brinlitz to have a look at the Hoffmann brothers' cloth factory. He was able to walk into the empty building without being challenged and was delighted with what he found. There was enough space for his machines, his offices, his own apartment, and upstairs there was space for his Jews to live. He knew that the people of Brinlitz would not be happy with the idea of more than 1,000 Jews moving into their neighborhood so late in the war. But after seeing this place, Oscar was determined to spend whatever money was needed, to talk to the necessary people, and to move his Jews to Brinlitz. A week after Oscar's meeting with Susmuth, the gentleman of the appropriate Berlin office instructed the difficult governor in his castle in Liberec that Oscar Schindler's factory, with its military contracts and skilled workers, would be moving into the Hoffmann brothers' empty building in Brinlitz. The governor and other officials complained that 1,000 Jews would bring disease and crime into the area. They said that Oscar's small factory would do very little to help the war effort, but could make Brinlitz a target for enemy bombs. They put signs up in the area which said, "Keep the Jewish criminals out." But the protests had no effect, because they had to go straight to Colonel Erich Lang's office in Berlin. So, with the help of Lang and Susmuth, Oscar's plans went forward. But every step along the way was expensive. He had to pay to get permits, to get money moved from one bank account to another, to make friends in Brinlitz. No one wanted cash, so Oscar had to search everywhere for tea, leather shoes, carpets, coffee, fish, whatever the people in charge wanted. One of the people Oscar had to keep happy was Commandant Hasbrook at Gross Rosen. Under Hasbrook's management, 100,000 people died in the Gross Rosen system. But when Oscar talked to him, he found him to be a type he had met before, a charming killer. Hasbrook was excited about extending his empire further into Czechoslovakia. He already controlled 103 subcamps and was pleased to be getting number 104. Commandant Buscher, who had replaced Amon Goert at Plaschow, knew about Schindler's list and told Oscar that it had to be completed and on his desk by a certain day. There were more than 1,000 names on the dozen pages, which were the only papers in Plaschow with any connection to the future. The list included the names of all the prisoners of the subcamp at DEF, as well as new names, including Helen Hirsch. Oscar had allowed Raymond Tisch to add names of prisoners from Madrisch's factory, but he had stopped him after 70 names because Berlin had set a limit of 1,100 for the list. One name that had been included from the beginning was Itzhak Stern, Oscar's most trusted advisor and friend during all his years in Krakow. When the list was out of Oscar's hands, more names were added by Marcel Goldberg, the personnel clerk at Plaschow. The Plaschow authorities were busy with the job of closing the camp and would sign any list Goldberg gave them as long as there were not many more than 1,100 names on it. After adding his own name, Goldberg, known as Lord of the Lists, took bribes to add more.
For this list, it takes diamonds, he told people.
After the war, every survivor had a story about how this person or that one got on the list. Leopold Pfefferberg, for example, did not have any diamonds to give Goldberg, but with his trading skills, he was able to get hold of a bottle of whiskey. With this in hand, he went to talk to Hans Schreiber, an SS officer who had an evil reputation, but for some reason found Pfefferberg amusing and interesting. The Jew gave Schreiber the bottle and begged him to force Goldberg to add his and Miller's names to the list.
Yes, Schreiber agreed. The two of you must get on it.
And when the time came, the Pfefferbergs found themselves there. The mystery is why men like Schreiber did not ask themselves, if this man and his wife are worth saving, why aren't the rest? The men on Schindler's list, including Marcel Goldberg, who must have left his bags of diamonds with someone in Krakow, climbed into the boxcars of a cattle train at the Plaszow station on Sunday, the 15th of October, 1944. The women would leave a week later. The 800 Schindler men were kept separate on the train from an additional 1,300 prisoners who were heading for Gross Rosen. The Schindler Jews expected to be taken directly to Brinlitz, and so they were fairly tolerant of the difficult conditions during their three-day journey. The train moved slowly, and snow was already falling in this part of Poland. Each prisoner had been given less than half a kilogram of bread to last the entire trip, and each boxcar had been provided with a single water bucket. Instead of a toilet, the travellers had to use a corner of the floor, or the space in which they stood, if their car was really crowded. But the Schindler men continued to feel hopeful about their destination, Brinlitz and Herr Schindler. Finally, the train reached its destination late on the third day. The doors were unlocked, and the SS guards ran among the prisoners, shouting,
"Hurry up! Everyone off the train! Take off all your clothes! Everything must be disinfected!"
The prisoners piled their clothes and shoes on the ground and looked around, realizing they were in the main square of the Gross Rosen concentration camp. Was a Schindler camp in Czechoslovakia just a dream? There was no room in the prisoner barracks at Gross Rosen, and so the men were kept on the square all night with nothing to protect their bodies from the bitter weather. In later years, when talking about those 17 hours in the severe cold, survivors did not mention any deaths. Maybe life under the SS had made them tough enough to live through such horrors. Towards 11 o'clock the next morning, the prisoners had all their hair shaved off by Ukrainian soldiers before they were taken to the showers. Leopold Pfefferberg crowded into the shower with the others and looked up, wondering if it would be gas or water that came out. To everyone's relief, it was water. And after washing, the men were given striped prison uniforms and crowded into barracks. The SS guards made them sit in lines. One man backed up between the legs of the man behind him, his opened legs giving support to the man in front. By this method, 2,000 men were crowded into three barracks and covered every inch of the floor. Each day the prisoners had to stand in silence for 10 hours in the camp's main square. Then they were given thin soup in the evenings and had a little time to walk and talk together before going back at 9 o'clock to their barracks and their odd sitting position for the night. On the second day, an SS officer came to the barracks looking for the clerk who had been in charge of Schindler's list. Somehow, it had not been sent with the prisoners from Plaszow. Marcel Goldberg was led off to an office and asked to type out the list from memory. By the end of the day, he had not finished the work, and back in the prisoners' barracks, he was surrounded by people making sure that he had remembered their names and begging him to include other friends and family members. Then, on the third day, the 800 men of the rewritten list were separated out from the mass on the square, taken to the showers for another wash, permitted to sit for a few hours and talk like villagers in front of their barracks, and at last marched to the railway track again. Their train travelled 160 kilometres, and the doors opened early in the morning of the second day at Zwittau station. The Schindler men and a few boys got off the train and were marched through the sleeping town. Zwittau had not been touched by the war. It looked as though it had been asleep since the late 1930s. The group tramped 5 or 6 kilometres into the hills to the industrial village of Brinlitz, where they saw the solid-looking buildings of the Hoffmann factory, and to one side the Brinlitz labour camp, with watchtowers, a wire fence around it, and some barracks for the guards. As they marched through the gate, Oskar Schindler appeared from the big building inside the fence, smiling and wearing a Sudeten country gentleman's hat. They were home again.